Well, it's 5 minutes after 12, and quite a number of people have joined in the last couple of minutes. And so we'll get started with the webinar. I'm Tessa Hebb, and I'm the director of the Responsible Investing Initiative, which is a community university research alliance based here at the Carleton Center for Community Innovation. Most of you will have received your Responsible Investing Initiative electronic newsletter that would have told you about the webinar today. This is it's my pleasure to have Ben Richardson of University of British Columbia, Margie Mandel and Erica Barbosa of Margie of Concordia University, and Erica with the McConnell Foundation as our presenters today. This is the third presentation, third webinar in our series this year, and that means six papers from the Responsible Investing Initiative CURA have been presented in this series. All six of these papers were presented last October in academic conferences, and this starting next month in November, we will be presenting a new series of papers at the Principles for Responsible Investment Academic Network. And in 2014, we will host a series of webinars where those papers are presented. But today, it's my pleasure to first turn the webinar over to Ben Richardson. Ben holds the Canada Research Chair at the University of British Columbia Law Faculty, and his area of specialty is in fiduciary law and socially responsible investing. And Ben will be speaking to us today rather than video or PowerPoint. And so, Ben, I am going to turn the presentation over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tessa, for that kind introduction, and thank you to the RRI for setting this up. The purpose of my presentation today is to talk about some problems and challenges in the governance of retail funds in the SRI sector. There curiously has been rather limited attention about the retail fund sector compared to institutional funds such as pension plans. And so the purpose is to highlight some of the legal issues that arise in the retail fund sector and to clarify other things beyond law that I think are quite pertinent to understanding SRI and retail funds. And my central argument is that although the law creates a rather permissive and liberal environment that is, in fact, quite conducive to SRI and retail funds, in fact, we don't get such extensive SRI as one would expect, and the quality suffers. And I think what that suggests is that law itself provides an imperfect and limited insight into how SRI works in practice. And I want to highlight some of the things that I think undermine SRI in the retail fund sector to go beyond law. So the starting point for this discussion is an area of law that's known as fiduciary and trust law, and anyone who works in the SRI sector probably has some familiarity with that, but I will just touch on a few introductory dimensions. It is widely regarded as the principal legal influence on SRI. For example, if you look at the UN Principles for Responsible Investment, which is the SRI code most widely endorsed by investors, it's prefaced by the proviso that says, we're consistent with our fiduciary responsibilities, we commit. So a fiduciary is a person in some sort of position of trust or confidence with respect to another, and the other is typically known as the beneficiary. And in a legal system such as Canada's, but also in the United Kingdom and the United States, in which fiduciary law is most commonly found, a fiduciary has four important obligations. One is to act with loyalty in the interests of beneficiaries. Secondly, to act even-handedly, in other words, to treat beneficiaries consistently and uniformly. Thirdly is to exercise care, skill, and prudence. And fourthly is to follow any governing instrument, like the prospectus of an investment fund. Now, most of the academic opinion and some judicial court opinion suggests that those foregoing duties blunt and limit the scope for SRI if beneficiaries either don't want it or if it would be financially imprudent. Now, the problem with that kind of opinion is that it tends to gloss over distinctions between different types of funds, mutual funds, insurance companies, pension trusts. And what my work has been trying to do with the RRI initiative is to sort of highlight that there are important differences in each sector. And let's now talk about mutual funds, which I'll use as the label generically to refer to retail funds. Mutual funds can take the form of either a corporation or a trust. The trust, such as income fund trusts, are often used in Commonwealth countries such as Canada and the United Kingdom. And here investors hold units that represent a proportionate beneficial share of the trust assets. The corporate structure, in other words, a company, is used more commonly in the United States and Australia. And here investors hold shares in the funds that are set up by the investment companies. But whether it's a trust or a corporation, the directors or managers of those funds have fiduciary responsibilities to the unit holders or shareholders to follow the fund's objectives in a loyal and competent manner. Now, the default legal position is that a fund manager will maximize risk-adjusted returns in a mutual fund. But this is where it gets interesting. That rule is modified. It can be modified in two situations. The first is where a fund adopts and discloses an investment policy such as SRI that might affect profitability. So it could be the prospectus issued by the fund or the articles of incorporation of an investment company. These are means by which SRI policies can be adopted and conveyed which modify that fiduciary duty to optimize financial returns. The other situation is where you have an investment company and there's a rule in the law called the business judgment rule. And what that rule does is to protect from scrutiny by courts, directors and managers who may, for example, not make as much money as they should when they're making informed good faith decisions in the interests of the company. So the fund manager of an investment company that has a cluster of mutual funds might be pursuing policies that promote SRI rather than necessarily maximizing profits. But the business judgment rule can protect those decisions from judicial scrutiny if it's done in good faith. The other entity that we need to keep in mind here in this topic, and it's a very important issue, is the role of financial advisors. Now, most mum and dad investors who are, let's say they want to put some money into a mutual fund, they will not approach the fund directly, but do so through an intermediary or a gatekeeper, and that's the financial advisor. That's because they may not have financial expertise, and financial advisors often act as brokers in selling mutual fund products. So this is important to this topic because it raises the question, do financial advisors also have fiduciary responsibilities to their clients? And in certain circumstances, they can, depending on what kind of advice and the kind of relationship that is set up with the client. And my view of the situation here is that there is a fiduciary responsibility to inquire into clients' values and preferences and to make known to them SRI options. In other words, a financial advisor should not be simply saying, well, you know, put your money into this mutual fund because it benefits the advisor in terms of commissions and remuneration. Rather, they've got to put the client's interest first. And if a client may be interested in ethical issues, to promote that and highlight investment options that would fulfill that. Now, that's sort of the basic legal position. Now, I want to highlight the problems that arise in practice. Because from the foregoing, you might come to the conclusion, wow, SRI should be flourishing in the mutual fund, retail fund sector, because the law allows funds to have an SRI policy if they want. Financial advisors need to think about the interests of clients. The reality is rather different, and there are a couple of problems. The first problem is acute market competitive pressures. What I'm talking about here is that mutual funds' capacity to promote SRI, I think, is undermined by an organizational culture that's very preoccupied by short-term returns and competitive advantage. Even the SRI funds habitually appeal to their financial credentials, and that same competitive pressure exists in parallel in the financial advisors and brokers. Now, by contrast, if you look at institutional funds such as pension plans, they are somewhat more insulated from that kind of market pressure because, of course, a pension fund is not necessarily directly selling an investment product to the public. And such pressures may result in fund managers being unwilling or unable, for example, to engage with companies on SRI issues because the costs involved and the aversion to other funds free riding on their efforts. So acute market pressures, I think, can undermine the integrity of the SRI market in the mutual fund sector. The second problem that my research has been looking at carefully is the problem of investor passivity. Now, in theory, the notion of a mutual fund implies some sort of democratic forum. It's a mutual. It's an association of investors who come together with a common objective. And you might think that it's a terrific forum for enlightened ethical deliberation. But the reality, of course, is that that just does not happen. Fund managers and directors of mutual funds have no incentive to really have investors having input and control over the governance of the fund. They certainly want to sign up investors. They want more clients and boost their fees, but they have little interest in promoting democracy and ethical deliberation. And my research, and based on some interviews, is that even among ostensible SRI funds, there really is very little emphasis placed on members' participation, apart from the occasional or informal survey of investor opinions. In other words, the conclusion that we can reach here is that mutual funds consider investors to be customers rather than active owners. And I find that an odd contradiction because the SRI industry increasingly talks about the need for active ownership in their own portfolio companies. But they don't show that same commitment to active engagement with their customers in terms of sort of democratic consultation and input. I think fiduciary law is partly to blame for that because it is premised on the notion that beneficiaries are passive. And I think in the mutual fund context, that's rationalized on the assumption that investment management is complex, specialized, and few people could undertake or understand that. But I think when it comes to making decisions about ethics and what values we want to have in investment, anyone is qualified to speak about their own values. I don't think it's an argument that is persuasive to say the beneficiary should be passive. There are other factors, of course, at work in explaining investor passivity. One is just apathy. I mean, people are busy, they're tired, and they may invest in mutual funds precisely because they don't want to invest directly in companies in their own name. And there certainly is on paper a lot of legal opportunities for people to participate in fund governance. For example, they can vote on changes to the investment policy, but generally those rights are not exercised. If someone doesn't like the SRI or financial policy of a fund, what they typically do is just take their money out and go elsewhere rather than try to exert a democratic voice for change. Now, I think the lack of democracy in retail funds is somewhat problematic because it robs the sector of the capacity for sort of public debate about its ethical parameters and robs it of the degree of legitimacy. But it may be that some of that debate happens elsewhere, such as forums like the SIO Annual Conference, the PRI Academic Network. But I'll come back to that. Another thing that I want to highlight in terms of the legal framework for SRI mutual funds is the role of transparency regulation. Whereas fiduciary law plays a very significant role in the governance of, say, pension plans, in the retail fund sector, the dominant tool that's been used is what I call transparency regulation to ensure accountability. And what this regulation does is to say, rather than dictate how funds should invest, investors have a right to have access to information from funds so they can make a rational decision. Now, Australia has gone the furthest in regulating disclosure of SRI-related information in the mutual fund sector. Canada does not have specific SRI-related disclosure rules, although general securities regulation does require disclosure of material information in an investment prospect so that clients aren't misled. Now, investment regulation that focuses on disclosure is theoretically attractive, but in practice, disclosures have tended to be less than transformative. If you look at the prospectus of many funds, they tend to be on SRI rather superficial, rather generic, the information, and there's a lot of rhetoric and hype. And I think investors, in fact, can be confused by the bewildering array of philosophies from evangelical Christian ethics to deep ecology that they'll find in the SRI sector. The other problem with disclosure standards is that they don't really allow investors to know about the methodology and the impact of a policy. In other words, it's a policy that says, for example, we take account of climate change or the plight of the Aboriginal people, but how that is implemented and whether it's successful, we don't hear very much about that. I think the closest that we've come to a pretty rigorous standard is the guidance given by the Australian Securities and Investments Commission that tries to cajole funds to be attentive to that in their disclosures. Disclosure is important because if a fund doesn't practice what it preaches, it faces legal liability. And there is a few cases. One from the United States involves Pax World, and it incurred a $500,000 fine from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission for misleading investors about its SRI practices. It had a policy about excluding alcohol and tobacco, and it was found to have been, in fact, investing in that area when it shouldn't have been. So in summary, I don't think fiduciary law creates a significant legal hindrance to SRI in the retail sector in the way that it is in some other sectors. But the flip side is that this is a legal approach that does not necessarily encourage or mandate SRI. Rather, it lets the market decide the optimal level of SRI, and it aims to support that market through disclosure regulation, assuming that rational social investors will then make informed decisions. The reality is that we find that the relative permissive legal environment has enabled SRI practices to flourish that I think sometimes can be considered like rigor and integrity. There's a lot of emphasis on marketing and competitive advantage rather than sort of a democratic deliberation about SRI policies. Should we care about this? Are there any solutions, just to close in the final minute? In theory, one can impose sort of draconian prescriptive regulation that obliges retail fund managers and directors to consult with their members on SRI issues. But I think that would be a nightmare. It would be very difficult and intrusive to administer, and many investors may be simply too apathetic to care anyway. Another option is that we could have mutual fund disclosure laws that are more detailed in their requirements, explaining the methodology behind a statement of SRI to disclose the impact and success. But again, I'm not sure that investors are going to read that information in the level of attention that would make them change their behaviour. Another route might be to say the SRI retail fund sector needs to collaborate and have more active dialogue with outside groups. The role of the UNEP FI, the UNEP Finance Initiative, I think is a sort of a multi-stakeholder forum that could be seen as a precedent that maybe the retail fund sector needs to set up to have that ethical debate. In other words, if it's not going to happen within funds, at least have it at a more general level. And we might also want to revisit what it means to have fiduciary responsibility in these funds. Perhaps the fiduciary should be imbued with a greater sense of social responsibility to play an active and benevolent role. I don't have answers to these challenges, but rather my aim is really to stimulate analysis of the problems and debate about how we might improve accountability. Thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you, Ben. Your work is always so instructive in terms of how we think about these issues with the legal fiduciary lens that is really a major element when we come to think about institutional investors involved in SRI generally. Now, what I would like people to do, many of you have control of your own microphone. So first, if you should see a chat box at the bottom of your GoToMeeting, please let me know if you would like to ask a question, and I will call on you and either unmute you or you will unmute yourself. In the meantime, I'm going to lead off with some questions while I'm waiting for people to think through, because you've given us a lot, Ben, to think about over the course of the presentation that you've made today. But I'm going to start where you left off, you know, with this list of what could be done, because one of the things that we know about the SRI industry is that it has not grown as quickly as many people anticipated that it would. And you've given us a list of ways in which the growth and the take-up of SRI by individuals and by mutual funds could be encouraged. I was thinking about the disclosure requirement that you mentioned. As we know, in the UK, pension funds are required to disclose if and to what extent they're using environmental, social, and governance factors in their investment decision-making. And do you think that this type of legislative approach could be useful in the mutual fund industry? And, you know, would you see that as a possible approach in Canada?
Thank you for that question, Tessa. I am quite familiar with the UK model, and it's been adopted in a number of other pension plans in continental Europe. The research on the effectiveness of that is that it's encouraged some sort of boilerplate generic disclosures. It has led to a lot more consideration of SRI and pension funds. But whether it's being transformative remains to be seen, and I think we may need to give those sorts of reforms time. In the retail fund sector, the only jurisdiction that I'm aware of that has adopted a similar kind of reform is Australia, as I was touching on. And again, the message from Australia is that it's sort of had a mixed impact. It funds must disclose, and so we see a lot more disclosures. But whether it's really been transformative, I think really is an area that would benefit from a lot of significant research. If Canada was, as I said at the outset, I mean, Canada's general securities regulations do require disclosure in investment prospects of prospectus of material information, and that would include SRI. But there's no duty to disclose, you know, whether or not you have an SRI policy at large. I don't know whether it would be transformative in Canada or anywhere else, because I fear that an underlying problem is that investors are apathetic. It takes time to read prospectuses. It takes time to act on this information. And it may be that it's better to have the sort of ethical debate and discussion and transparency at a different level, at a higher level. And maybe the SRI sector needs sort of the equivalent of something like the United Nations Environment Programme Finance Initiative, a forum in which there's a lot of debate with other stakeholders and discussion and that goes on. So, you know, I do believe in the role of law, Tessa, but often regulation is not very helpful.
Yes, I mean, I was thinking about this in your challenge of the passivity of investors. You know, we often hear this comment that even when the investors, the SRI investors, are surveyed, they often say, and non-SRI mutual fund holders as well, they say that they are interested in SRI, they would like to invest in SRI as long as it doesn't impact financially on their portfolio. I mean, do you think that these two positions are consistent or inconsistent? Does it get at some of the ethical questions that I know that you raise in your work?
Well, as you know, Tessa, there's a lot of research on the financial performance of SRI, and I think that retail investors tend to be more sensitive to financial returns than institutional investors because it is much more directly their own money at stake, where in a pension fund, it's a little less direct to see the connections. So I think retail funds in the SRI sector that try to be indifferent to financial returns are not likely to be successful. So the industry probably will thrive when it is more attentive to the business case. Of course, sometimes there may be no business case for SRI, in which case it'll only get us so far. So it's a two-edged sword. We need to highlight the financial value of SRI, but we also face a roadblock when sometimes that value is not evident or is not going to exist. You know, there could be, for example, on issues like climate change.
Now, I have a PhD candidate, Jennifer Goodman, here with me, and I think she has a question for you.
Yes, Jennifer.
Yeah, just a question. I'm wondering if it's really realistic or even desirable to have all shareholders really actively involved in developing policy for an SRI fund. I mean, there's constraints of time, knowledge, and then with different conflicting shareholder interests, isn't it almost an impossibility to arrange all of that?
Well, I agree that democracy in practice can be very impractical, costly, and unwieldy. And it's rather far-fetched to imagine mutual funds being an incubator of democratic and enlightened debate about SRI. On the other hand, having, you know, an absence of any democratic discussion tends to rob SRI of an important dimension, which is that it's focusing on values. And the question is, whose values? I mean, how do they come about? So if we accept that it's unlikely to occur within a mutual fund among its own investors, then we have to say, well, where can we have that debate about values? The fact that people have different values is not an excuse to say we're not going to have some sort of public debate and accountability about that. You know, the differences in values can be seen as a good thing because it requires that we debate and consider and defend. And I think my conclusion is that we're going to have to look to entities beyond individual funds to try to find that. And it may be that we need sort of industry-wide forums and forums that involve other stakeholders such as securities regulators, environmental NGOs, human rights groups. They're forums in which we might find fewer participants, but they're represented through, you know, organizations such as one or two representatives from environmental groups, one or two from human rights groups, a few from mutual funds. So you're right, Jennifer, it's a very challenging problem, but it's not an excuse to walk away from it. Thank you.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for your presentation of this paper today. Your work is always very much at the leading edge of these questions from the fiduciary and legal perspective. I think you have a new book that is just out now, do you not?
Yes, it's called The Fiduciary Law and Responsible Investing in Nature's Trust. It came out in April. It's published by Routledge. And thank you, Tessa, for putting a promo about it on the RRI website.
So, so if people want to dig into these questions a little bit more, Ben's new book or his papers have been published in a various journals, and you can find links to this paper from the Responsible Investing Initiative website on the Carleton Center for Community Innovation. So thanks, Ben. I'm going to turn the presentation over now to Margie Mendel and Erica Barbosa of Concordia University. I'm going to ask Margie and Erica to turn on their video camera, and I'm going to change the presenter to Margie and Erica, who are going to take us through their paper, Impact Investing, a Preliminary Analysis of Emergent Primary and Secondary Exchange Platforms. Hi, Margie and Erica. Great to see you.
Hi. We're together, but we'll take turns speaking. And we've got a stopwatch, so we'll be very quiet. Can you hear us?
Yes, we can.
Okay. The title of this paper is a Preliminary Analysis of Emergent Primary and Secondary Exchange Platforms, and we delivered this, as you said, Tessa, last year in the fall, and it remains a preliminary analysis. That requires further work that we intend to do. But I just want to go back to some points which perhaps are quite obvious to at least to those of us who are involved in this CURA, but perhaps less so to others who are listening today, and that is that the CURA is a partnership between community organizations or financial institutions involved in this space, there are researchers working with these organizations. And in our case, the paper that we wrote was in direct response to a need expressed by our partners, in particular the partners in Quebec, a quasi or equity or patient capital fund called the Fiducie du Chantier de l'Économie Sociale. Sorry about that. It'll just ring. It'll go off. I meant to turn off my ringer. Sorry. It'll stop. Apologize. So we responded to the request by our practitioner partners to explore what is happening with respect to the development of platforms, of exchange platforms, primary and secondary markets, in particular because there is a need to raise more liquidity for these markets in Quebec and also to consider exit strategies. And I'm sort of skipping, but I'll stay with our slides. So we looked, before we went into answering the actual question, we went back to look at what the landscape is, particularly in Quebec and internationally, in this large universe called impact investing. And it turns out something that we knew but we wanted to include in the paper that we wrote was that impact investing is an all-embracing term and that, in fact, there's a lot of historical activity in what previously would have been called perhaps social finance, social banking, ethical banking, and so on. And in Quebec, a lot of these institutions that are engaged in this kind of activity are networked in a network called CAP Finance, and you can see on the slide the list of the members of CAP Finance. These organizations or institutions invest in collective enterprises, that is, cooperatives and non-for-profit businesses. And if we follow the evolution of social enterprise, which is on the demand side, the largest percentage of social enterprises are, in fact, not-for-profit businesses. So we wanted to demonstrate that there is a historical, that there's a long history of this kind of activity, which is now captured by impact investing. And what distinguishes impact investing from this historical evolution is the the participation of high net worth individuals, foundations, pension funds, and an increasing appetite for so-called ethical investment. So we can go to the next slide. And this diagram here, which is quite primitive in many ways, tries to demonstrate that there are many, many players internationally that range from, microcredit all the way to quasi-equity, the markets that they're trying to serve or the organizations that they're trying to serve, and who the various players are involved. And after following the interest of the Rockefeller Foundation and the work of Anthony Buglevine in particular, who coined the term impact investing, we believe that this picture in front of you really captures this market. But despite this rapid growth, and many of us are now studying this field, I think the number of us doing research in this area is beginning to catch up with the number of players in this field. But there are still barriers around measurement, despite the fact that there have been huge advances in metrics by Jin, Iris, others, Tessa, the document that you produced, which is a manual effectively for those who are engaged in impact investing. Despite that, there are still confusions around developing a common vocabulary, standardization, the perception of this market. The standardization, which we wrote last year, actually has generated a lot of debate now, particularly in foundations that are saying, well, just a second, maybe we shouldn't be standardizing because if we standardize everything, then we're going to be investing in low-lying fruit and we're not going to be able to account for the diversity of the enterprises and organizations that are requiring this kind of capital. The market remains fragmented. Regulation is uneven, non-existent in some places, emergent in others. Barriers include the necessity for enabling policy measures. The way we see it, and you know, much of this arrival of this investment capital is welcome, but on the other hand, it's largely supply driven. There doesn't seem to be enough discussion of who or which organizations actually need and are receiving this funding. There's an ongoing need for financial innovation and new financial products. The other barrier is that, by and large, these are debt instruments and usually secured debt instruments. And often we see that we need to consider the whole life cycle of an enterprise and its different needs, its needs for different investment products. So that was the background for us to have a look at what were the, you know, what was the current state and future of social exchange platforms. You know, where are they? What is the work that they're doing? Are they contributing to bringing some coherence and coordination to this market, which for now remains fragmented? Are they generating liquidity? Because when you read the literature or you read the reports from the institutions or organizations needing this capital, access to capital is still out there as a principal need that hasn't been satisfied. And then again, you know, what opportunities are available? Is this about low-hanging fruit and small enterprises or startups are still having difficulty accessing? So we looked at a few exchange platforms that exist, only a few, but they're rather big. And then we also included the Community Reinvestment Fund in Minnesota, which is a very old, I mean, 25 years, I believe, community development finance, financial institution in the United States. It is a fascinating example of how they've been able to internally create a secondary market and capitalize a lot of the investments that they have, which for a long time were primarily in the housing sector, which is a big need in the United States, but they have diversified and invested in enterprises as well. We're not going to go into detail, but we'll just, you know, tell you right now that there's a lot of activity going on in terms of coordination and collaboration between some of these exchanges. So the data sources, we looked at websites, documents, academic publications, and secondary material, but also Erica and another graduate student who worked with us did, and I participated when I could, on telephone interviews with key people in these secondary or primary markets to be able to really dig in and see what the current challenges are. And the analysis, the 7 points that we wished to address are listed on the left. We wanted to identify whether these platforms were facilitating primary or secondary transactions or both, whether they had access or providing access to capital for both profit and nonprofit enterprises, what were the different tools and products that they were able to provide, what were their processes and due diligence methodologies, who were their target investors and investees, their reporting mechanisms, and the regulatory environment in which they operated. And I'm going to 10 minutes, and I'm going to give the next 10 minutes to Erica to continue.
Thank you, Margie. Just an important remark is that at the time that we did this research, most of these platforms had not yet been launched. So, and a few of them have started their operations now. But just in terms of what we were able to identify and some of the trends in the at the time that we looked at this, we can see that for the most part, most of the platforms that we were looking at were serving as a primary platform that is just highlighting the different types of enterprises and acting as a clearinghouse. Only a few of them were intending to offer secondary transactions, but that is and even now has not yet been realized in terms of transaction capacity on the platforms. The most the largest ones, which are the Social Stock Exchange and NEXI, for the most part, are promoting for-profit enterprises, and of course, those would be the ones that would be that are looking to enable secondary transactions by trading shares on the platforms. One of the platforms, that the one in Asia, is one of the few ones that is looking at how can they start to enable a secondary market for nonprofits as well. In terms of what are the types of enterprises that are listing or that are going to start listing on these platforms, there's a wide range in terms of size primarily. So here we have we can look at what are the different revenue sizes of the enterprises that are a requirement on each of the platforms, or the market capitalization that they're looking for. So these are they tend to be large enterprises in size. In terms of geographic reach, these platforms are offering an opportunity for enterprises internationally. And then there are some that are local, like the Social Venture Connection in Ontario, which is one of the ones that was just recently launched this past month. In terms of which sectors are being enabled to list on these platforms, in principle, it's all sectors: education, consumer products, green environment, clean technologies. It is just a reality, however, that the current opportunities are skewed towards more developed sectors in the space. So, I'm sorry, microfinance institutions, asset-backed enterprises like housing, and clean technologies. We also looked at what are the different due diligence processes and social impact monitoring methods that these platforms are using. And many of them are using third-party ratings, like GEARS, the Global Impact Investing Rating System, and B Corp stamps, which apply to for-profit enterprises. And then for those that are working on nonprofits, as well as some others, they have some customized prospectus and due diligence that they do up until the point of listing on the platforms. So they're reducing some costs to potential investors, and as well as enterprises in linking them. We one of the things that we wanted to ask them is, as they're because it took a very long time for many of them from inception and launch to actually become operational, and some are still underway. And when we asked about the challenges, many of them resemble all the different challenges that are faced by the industry at large. So one of them, it has to do with transaction costs. Many of the enterprises, particularly for those platforms that have international reach, are around the globe and are small in size, and so the costs of due diligence are quite high. This is a nascent space, and there's still a lot of need to disseminate knowledge and know-how across the different stakeholders, both between investors, the people that are involved in intermediation to some extent, and those networks and knowledge dissemination still needs to increase. There seems to be a continued highlight of the low deal flow and the need for capacity building in some enterprises and investment readiness support. Some of the enterprises, that the platforms that have listed right now, have a range of 10 to 12 enterprises that are listed, and some of them are including in their model the option and windows to be able to access capacity support grants for enterprises that will be listed. This is particular of NEXI. Regulation is also a difficulty. Many of them have seen their launches delayed because the regulators and securities practitioners themselves are trying to struggle and learn what are the complexities about this new space. In terms of, despite these challenges, however, the platforms are fulfilling and are starting to fulfill an interesting role in building to some extent the marketplace and creating some infrastructure for exchange. They are certainly, and the whole space of social enterprises is challenging investment models, assumptions about risk and profitability. And as we start to see the emergence of hybrid enterprises, we're also challenging the current models. But these require increased a new branding, legislation, regulation, and understanding for investors to really recognize what the potential for profit generation is of these enterprises. Governance is a very important issue because the role of shareholders in these new models is very different from what we're used to. As Martin was mentioning before, the need for capital continues to be identified as a key challenge, and despite some efforts in building mediation, we're not moving the pace that we might want to for the benefit of communities and enterprises themselves. And there are, again, as Martin was mentioning, some question around the issue of standardization and the conflation of diversity, not just in terms of metrics and measurement, but in terms of processes as well. When it comes to the metrics and to measurement, the constant trade-off between being able to aggregate information and understand what the level of impact is, and that with and the trade-off with customization and uniqueness of the enterprises. And I think I will allow Margie to start with some of the conclusions, or I'll start and then you can finish off, Margie. Some important conclusions is that while this is a work in progress, and we're very excited to actually see that some of the platforms are starting their operations, because we believe that they will have an important contribution to developing the marketplace. They're certainly very different in nature, most of them, and they're at very early stages of development. A reality is that they primarily serve as a primary for primary transactions, where they allow for transactions, because not all of them are transactional platforms. But they're important. There's an important role as a clearing house, at least to reduce some of the costs of investment in the space. The challenges that we face in terms of development of secondary transactions come down to the traditional barriers around legal structures, not-for-profits not being able to capitalize in the same way as for-profits in capital markets. And so the question about how do we either create new forms or new exit strategies for investors or some type of secondary market in this space is still a very important one. And Marcia, would you like to?
Just to quickly wrap up, I had mentioned earlier that most of the opportunities at the moment tend to go towards more profitable and asset-backed investments for obvious reasons, because the risk is perceived to be much lower. And so if we are concerned with why this market emerged in the first place, that's an important question for us to address. And to deconstruct and analyze. Again, the necessity for a diversity of tools and products, so that it isn't only loans, asset-backed loans, which tend to dominate the market at the moment, and to be able to respond to the different phases of development of the industries or organizations or enterprises that this investment is, where this investment is needed. Again, the measurement issues, this is basically wrapping up what I had said earlier, issues around regulation. And as we speak, there's all sorts of innovations that we would like. We're sort of trying to follow this market as it emerges. Bonds. I refer specifically here to community bonds and not social impact bonds for this market. Different special purpose vehicles. There's where does this whole surge of crowdfunding fit in? For example, shared impact is an example of a kind of crowdfunding, initiative. What can we learn from the CDFI market? Because it's very, very well structured, and I think that there are important lessons to be learned from what is going on in the U.S., including on the bond side, where the U.S. Treasury is now guaranteeing $10 billion in community bonds that will be deployed by the CDFIs across the United States. So there's a great deal more research, and I think the fact that I think that's our last slide. Am I right? Okay. The need for exit strategies remains. We go back to this whole notion of legal form. I mean, so long as we're dealing with a traditional secondary market structure that's basically the stock market and shareholders and the capacity to buy and sell and exit. I mean, that's the model that we're trying to adapt, and there is still not a solution to how to address exit strategies for these hybrid enterprises. And so policy becomes absolutely essential. Regulation, legislation, fiscal incentives. There's credit enhancements such as loan guarantees. Our work continues. Erica mentioned branding, for example. Branding is not enough. I mean, we need more legal form. In BC, they just passed legislation to create a community benefit commission, similar to the CICs in the UK. So there's, in that sense, the demand side is really interesting. We have to follow both at the same time to see how new legal forms will enable investors to enter this market more effectively and with more knowledge of what their risks are, and if we need to create secondary markets or transactions platforms, it'll make it much easier, as opposed to only issuing shares, which is what secondary markets are able to do at the moment. We'll stop there.
Well, thank you both, Margie and Erica, for such an interesting presentation, and as everybody knows, the paper is available on the 3CI website, and I would certainly suggest, if you haven't been able to have a chance to look at it, then to please take a look. Now I'm going to unmute Tina. Tina, would you like to ask your question of Margie and Erica?
Yeah, I wanted to ask what you thought, after doing this research, would be the key area or activity that everyone could participate in to increase investor confidence.
Well, okay, so we're not looking now necessarily at the transaction platforms, but rather how to get investors involved in this activity in the first place. I mean, Erica and I had a long conversation on Sunday. This is how we spend Sundays, about risk and how we have to really dig in to understand perception, perception, to distinguish between perception and reality. And the fact is that, once we're in this new universe of social enterprises that by and large are not-for-profit, with some exceptions, there is a perceived risk that has to be addressed. But interestingly enough, this is why history matters. If we look at some of those historic examples of social investment that has taken place, by social banking, ethical banking, these different institutions that have existed in Quebec, the cooperative movement, credit unions, and so on, largely in the debt space. Nonetheless, they did not fare badly at all during the crisis. I mean, we have some very concrete evidence to dispel this risk myth that seems to, create resistance among new investors. So it's not a surprise that the new investment market are the large players that are moving into the large microfinance institutions, for example, internationally, where risk is considerably mitigated. As soon as you're in a large intermediary, the question of risk becomes less. It's always important, but it's less worrisome. So we have a perception issue, but I think that we have a job to do, and that is, rather than look forward, let's look backwards at the same time, and show what has gone on in the U.S., in Canada, in Europe. And particularly, post-crisis, where the the catastrophe that was felt in mainstream markets was not felt in these markets. And just to add very, very quickly, in Quebec, if we look at the Caisse de dépôt, for example, the large pension fund, it lost, I think, Tessa, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was $40 billion in the crisis. And then if you look at the Fonds de solidarité and Fonds d'action, which are labor solidarity funds, which are, you know, effectively in the same space, they did not suffer those grave losses. Why? Because there are regulations, and they are regulated, and they were prevented from moving as dramatically into those risky, speculative financial markets. So, I think that there's an issue of perception.
And I would just like to add to that, because I agree with the problem about perception. But then I think there's an increased need to share information and translate across the different sectors some of the experiences, some of the track record. And I don't mean standardized metrics or measurements, et cetera, because we even need to redefine how it is that risk is assessed in the first place, especially in the context of this field. But this is something that we experience even within the foundation as we get a little bit more involved in impact investing, where the investments that we do that are looking for market rates of return, it's rare that we are going to be involved in an investment that has to do with the nonprofit sector. And so even within institutions that are involved in this space, and there's a miscommunication, or the tools that we have available for the assessments and the decisions that we're making are not yet adapted and updated for the context of this field.
Well, you know, this is such an interesting discussion, and I'm going to be looking forward as we go into the next year in our webinar series that we will have a couple of more papers on various aspects of impact investing coming forward. I do see that it's 1 o'clock, and so that's going to bring us to the end of the webinar today. I would like to thank again Ben Richardson of University of British Columbia, and of course Margie and Erica, Concordia and McConnell Foundation. A terrific webinar today, and as I say, stay tuned, everybody who's on the webinar, for our next series. Those papers are going to be presented at the upcoming Principles for Responsible Investment Academic Network, and then they will be presented over the course of the year. I think we may want to have, Margie, a special webinar session on some of these impact investing questions, as we know that there's tremendous interest. And I myself had 3 questions to ask, and I've had to put them aside because we're at the end of our session today. But thank you so much.